We'll call the Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, to order. It's 1:30. Got lots to do today. We got Senate Bill 56 in front of us. We had him, had Senator Dyson introduce it to us last go-around. Now we're going to bring it up for consideration. However, I am allotting you 20 minutes. If you can't do it in 20 minutes, then we're just going to put it aside. And then I've got three amendments to go into Senate Bill 22. And by 2:05, my intention is to begin public hearing again on 49. So that's kind of the schedule I'm going to shoot for. Identify yourself. Senator Dyson, do you want to? Okay. So we have Mr. Kopp in front of us. And identify yourself and whoever's going to be presenting with you on Senate Bill 56.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. With me is Forrest Baker, Forrest Dunbar, one of our local Alaska young men who's just back from Yale Law School and is here on a fellowship. And one of his research things was looking at our drug policy in Alaska. Briefly, we believe that the fiscal burden of our current drug policy is not sustainable. Senate Bill 56 will allow us to refocus our prison bed space on violent and career criminals. It does protect law enforcement abilities to aggressively pursue distributors and repeat offenders, and it will benefit our society by improving prospects for drug offenders to get jobs, be professionally licensed, get housing, and all variables strongly correlated with decreased alcoholism, DV, and recidivism. Section 1 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, amends criminal statute AS 1171-040, which is misconduct involving controlled substance fourth degree, by raising the quantity of Schedule 1A or 2A controlled substances that need to be found in an offender's possession that would precipitate a felony charge from the standard now, which is any amount, which is the smallest shaving or speck, just a detectable amount, to a quantity that would actually imply distribution before the felony would come into play. It establishes that the quantity possessed that implies distribution and opens an offender to a felony charge is 15 or more tabulates, ampules, or surettes, as identified in statute now, when the Schedule 1A or 2A is found in such a form. And just for the benefit of the committee, these Schedule 1A drugs are commonly known as codeine, hydrocodone, heroin. Schedule 2A is like meth and cocaine. It creates a carve-out for the substance heroin and lysergic acid, mainly due to the public safety risk and the toxicity level of heroin and LSD. So the carve-out is less than what is found otherwise at 3 grams for Schedule 1A and 2A, and it lowers for heroin the felony presumptive limit to 500 milligrams and to LSD 300 milligrams, about the size of an aspirin tablet. It provides for an escalating punishment system where a repeat offender found in possession of any amount of a Schedule 1A or 2A substance may still be prosecuted for misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, a Class C felony, if they have been previously convicted of any drug offense defined in AS 1171-010, which is misconduct controlled substance first, through AS 1171-050, which is misconduct involving a controlled substance fifth degree, in the 5 years preceding the current offense. So any one of those five drug offenses would count as two priors to a felony if they're arrested for a third time. It leaves unaffected any provisions of this statute or any other controlled substance statute that empowers law enforcement and prosecutors to charge and convict distributors of controlled substance. Section 2 of the bill begins at the top of page 3. And it provides that offenders found in possession of small quantities of a Schedule 1A and 2A substance may be prosecuted under the misconduct involving a controlled substance fifth degree statute, a Class A misdemeanor. And it establishes that an offender may be prosecuted of a misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree if they are found with any amount of a Schedule 1A or 2A substance up to the felony limit, above which they are subject to felony convictions under AS 1171-040, the current Mixed 4 statute. It does establish the felony limit, again, as 15 tabulates, ampules or surettes if the substance is found in such a form, or 3 grams if found in a preparation, compound, or mixture. This is approximately 1 gram, just for the chairman, so that's a gram.
Yeah, and you're showing a packet of
Sweet and Low.
Sweet and Low.
Yeah. Section 3 of the bill establishes that this act applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date of the act, except that the references to previous convictions and the escalating punishment or three strikes provisions of Section 1 include convictions occurring before, on, or after the effective date. And then Section 4 provides or removes conflicting language relating to bath salts from the Mix 4 and Mix 5 statute. After passage of this bill, bath salts will be treated as any other Schedule 2A controlled substance, which they currently are, with the same felony limits as, for example, methamphetamine. Section 5 provides for the effective date of this bill. That is the...
One last question. You went through it nicely, rapidly. Applicability, one more time. The on or after or before. Help me understand that one more time.
Yes, a conviction, offenses that would be committed on or after the effective date of the act, this would apply to, except that a reference in the act to a previous conviction, those previous convictions would apply in the escalating punishment. So when this bill came into law, if it was your third time within 5 years, you'd be subject.
Gotcha. All right. I didn't catch that your first go through. So.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, just for the record, there's one drafting error that we caught. It was simply a number, but it was important because there's so many drugs in the drug statute. But it's I just wanted to that we will have to introduce it.
Okay.
Just a drafting error catch.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. We have three people online we want to testify. The first one is Walt Monaghan. He is – oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, would you want me to go first?
Yes, I think so.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Identify yourself.
So, for the record, my name is Forrest Dunbar. I'm an attorney with the Office of Public Advocacy, but I'd like to stress that my comments today, while they relate to research I did last year while at OPA, I in no way represent OPA or the Department of Administration. So I think Chuck has already done a very good job explaining this SB 56, so I won't go over it too much more. The three strikes rule I want to stress. This helps us differentiate between people who are maybe a first-time abuser and a hardened criminal or someone who is a repeat offender. Again, I want to stress there are no restrictions placed on prosecutors and their ability to go after drug distributors, no matter how small the quantity they are caught with. If there's any evidence of distribution, they can be prosecuted with a felony, and this won't change that at all. But this provision should, SB 56, should lead to reductions in costs to the state of Alaska, both the prison system and the legal and judicial system. It'll also lead to fewer collateral consequences, barrier crimes, that kind of thing, placed on these low-level offenders. Finally, it will lead to fewer low-risk offenders being placed on felony probation, and therefore it should lead to a reduction in the caseload for probation officers. Very quickly, I know you've seen this graph already. This was presented by the Department of Corrections. This simply shows the number of beds in Alaska and our prison growth rate. You can see in 2016 the lines cross again. So we'll either have to build another Goose Creek or begin exporting Alaskans to Arizona and Colorado again, unless we can do something to start to bend that curve downward. Now, there was an internal memo in the Department of Corrections last year in August that identified three primary drivers of this prison growth. The first was low-level felony theft, which is addressed by Senator Coghill's bill, SB 43. The second was a 63% rise in admissions for drug offenses, particularly low-level, nonviolent drug offenses when they weren't selling drugs. They were simple possession offenses. And then finally, that will be addressed by SB 56. And finally, an increase in the petitions to revoke probation. It's a complicated issue, but it will be partially addressed by both SB 43 and SB 56 because this will reduce the number of people on DPP felony probation. Very quickly, there has been an increased number of Mix 4 charges, low-level drug possession charges, in the last 5 years. This is data provided by the court system during my research. I want to stress there are other ways to get a Mix 4, for example, if you were caught with a very large amount of marijuana. But when we're talking about the reforms in SB 56, we're only talking about the simple possession of 1A or 2A substances, including bath salts. This won't change that in the Mix 4 statute. So one of the important effects of this reform is that we'll have fewer people getting low-level felonies. Now, low-level felonies are very important because they lead to a variety of barriers to reentry, including housing, certain welfare programs, but most importantly, employment. And this is both in Alaska statute, but also in federal statute, and in district policy and in private policy. So in my research, for example, I called an HR department of a hiring firm for the North Slope. They said, we don't hire felons. Even low-level felons, we give them a 10-year cooling-off period. I spoke with the Anchorage School District. They said, we don't hire drug felons for 10 years, even if they're nonviolent, even if it's just for a janitorial position. And so what I want to stress is when you give these nonviolent offenders felony convictions, it becomes extremely difficult for them to reintegrate into the community. And I believe it helps drive recidivism because they cannot get legitimate employment. Talking about reduced costs directly to the state. Now, because of all those collateral consequences, people fight a felony conviction tooth and nail. And because of that, that's one of the reasons, it takes longer to reach disposition in a felony case versus a misdemeanor case. Now, this graph is a little bit confusing, but if you look at blue to blue and red to red, you can see that in both cases, felony cases in Superior Court take about twice as long to reach disposition as cases in Misdemeanor Court. Now, this, of course, leads to higher cost. They also leads to higher cost because you need, for a felony, you need to impanel a grand jury. You need a 12-person jury instead of a 6-person jury if you go to trial, which is relatively rare. But you also need more experienced and expensive attorneys, typically what's called an attorney four in a OPA or the department, the public defender. For that reason, I predicted after this, I estimate after this reform, we'll see between $400,000 and $800,000 in annual savings to the defense agencies and to the court. Now, I also reached out to the Department of Law for data during my research. They were unable to provide me with any. The Legislative Research Service also reached out to the Department of Law. They did not provide any data to them. But the LRS did do their own study, which found about $14 million in annual costs associated with these low-level drug crimes. Now, this primarily comes from the Department of Corrections. If we were to reclassify this as a misdemeanor, we would expect a number of people would not serve jail time, or they would serve shorter sentences. This is a little bit confusing, I know this graph. Predicting the exact bed impact was difficult, but what I did was I took estimates that have been done by the equivalent of legislative research in California and Colorado, where they contemplated similar reforms and actually passed in Colorado, and I tried to analogize it to Alaska, and I found a range of between $1.5 and $2 million in annual savings within 3 or 4 years. Now, that's significantly less than what the research was able to identify, although they were measuring a slightly different variable. But what I want to stress here is just that I believe this will save millions of dollars, and it could save tens of millions of dollars over the next decade. So the last thing I want to talk about, I know we're pressed for time, is public safety, and it's something this committee is very concerned with. And I want to stress that we will not be the first state to do this. We will not be the first state to classify low-level possession as a misdemeanor. There are 14 states in the country that already do so. So we will be joining the minority of states, but a pretty sizable portion of states. Now, while these states are concentrated in the Northeast, it is the case that they are pretty varied, as you can see from the map. There are poor states like Mississippi. There are rich states like New York. There are conservative states like Wyoming. There are liberal states like Vermont. And I think this is important because when we look at the data on the next slide, this helps us sort of figure out that there isn't some other kind of confounding factor that is systematically skewing our outcome data one way or the other. Now, if you look at the outcome data, and I didn't have rich enough data to make causal claims, but I just want to say it is the case that in misdemeanor states, for whatever reason, they have lower rates of violent crime, lower rates of property crime, lower rates of incarceration, lower rates of drug use, and a higher rate of drug treatment. And I think that last point is really important. As you can see, they have significantly higher rates of drug treatment. And I think this is something that our Department of Corrections now is rightly starting to focus on. But a counterargument has been raised to this bill that perhaps we won't be able to incentivize people to stay in treatment if they don't have the threat of a felony hanging over their head. That is demonstrably not the case. In states where this is a misdemeanor, they have higher rates of drug treatment. Furthermore, in the interviews I did with prosecutors and judges, what I heard over and over is, if we have enough time, suspended time, hanging over these people's heads, we can incentivize them to stay in treatment, regardless if we have the felony hammer or not. Now, the numbers I heard were 3 months, 6 months, up to 9 months. I never heard a year. I never heard more than a year. And as you know, with a Class A misdemeanor, we can sentence a possession offender to up to a year in prison. It also happens to be the case that rates of rape and domestic violence are lower in the misdemeanor states. And finally, so just in conclusion, again, I want to stress, I do not believe this will have a very large impact on public safety, but it will have a very large impact on this community in a as it reduces collateral consequences and improves employability. That actually might have an impact on recidivism. There was a very interesting study out of Florida that showed, because of a quirk in their law, they had certain people who get the exact same offense. Some of them would get felony labels, and some of them wouldn't, and this is unconnected to any kind of aggravators. Those who got the felony label were 17% more likely to offend than those who didn't. I believe that has to do with the fact that you get trapped in sort of the criminal milieu when you are not able to get employment when you have the felony label. Finally, we will see a reduction in probation officer caseloads, as we would with SB 43, and this will have direct cost savings to the state. This should run into the millions of dollars. Over the long term, it could run into the tens of millions of dollars. And if we're able to avoid the construction of Goose Creek through this effort, through efforts of the Department of Corrections and others, then we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Senator Dyson, you were saying that we had some folks on line to testify, so we do have Walt Monaghan on from the Alaska Native Justice Center. Walt, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you, sir. Real quickly, I want to emphasize that I agree with everything that has been stated so far. I like this bill in that it is based on a logical and an intuitive approach to addiction. It's treatment versus incarceration. It also provides a positive aspect of the escalating awareness of this behavior, giving the offender a chance and perhaps even a second chance to address this issue. And finally, it can forestall the branding of a felony upon a subject that will otherwise be carrying that thing for life, and that will close so many doors. And closing all those doors almost guarantees the continued drug use or abuse, and because it certainly limits other opportunities like jobs and as things have already been mentioned. I like it because it addresses something that I think has been long overdue. And we understand that most people, when they commit crimes now, they don't stop and dwell upon that, if I do this, it could be a felony. They do it because it's impulsive. This is it gives them a chance to say, okay, I made a mistake, but I can address it now. Or just like we did with the DUI. I mean, the escalating kind of part on there too. And I agree. I think this will, if it's passed, it will help reduce the offenders, current offenders' bitterness and antisocial behavior, the continued drug use, that they'll basically continue for primarily the rest of their adult lives or as long as they live. And it will affect in a positive way, subsequent crimes in order to find or obtain money to continue that drug abuse. It will also have a positive effect on domestic violence and child abuse and neglect. So for all these reasons, I support this bill.
Walt, I sure appreciate your testimony. I was going to try to see if we did it under 2 minutes. You did. Thank you very much.
Okay.
But you made your point, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I'm not trying to get in a hurry. I'm just trying to do this quickly.
And understood.
I know that's an awkward statement. I also have Rick Allen online. So, Rick, can you hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you identify yourself, who you're representing, and tell us what you're thinking.
Yes, sir. My name is Rick Allen, and I am the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. Before that, I was a prosecutor in the Palmer District Attorney's Office for about 7.5 years, and I have prosecuted hundreds of felony cases in my career. Today I will speak on the impact of SB 56 as it relates primarily to Office of Public Advocacy clients. Mr. Chairman, we must get prison population growth under control. Alaska has one of the fastest growing prison populations in the United States, one of few states where the population is still growing. Conversely, states like Texas are closing prisons. It has been said that we could have built 10 new high schools for the price of Goose Creek, and we will need to build another Goose Creek very soon if something is not done. There are devastating impacts of a felony conviction on individuals and families. We've heard about all of the employment prospects for the individual that are closed by a felony conviction, but the scope is actually larger than that. Studies show that having a parent in prison can be just as harmful to a child as witnessing or experiencing domestic violence. As a fiscally conservative state, it no longer makes sense for us to spend $50,000 a year to incarcerate people for $100 worth of drugs. We should consider the analysis of fiscal conservatives like Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich, and Bill Bennett, and reclassify our drug laws in an intelligent way. I think SB 56 does that. We know by looking at other states that reclassification will likely have no negative impact on public safety. I respectfully request this committee move this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate your public service, and that also goes for you, Mr. Monaghan. I appreciate it very much. I have in Fairbanks Mr. Burgraff. So can you hear us?
Yes. I'm not really prepared too much. Can you hear me very well?
I can hear you very well.
Okay. All right. I think this bill might have some good intentions. I really do feel that a lot of these drug-addicted people, especially, like, if we had a better medical system for these people in these, I mean, I've run across people who've been charged with felonies, been out of jail. They still have a drug problem. I mean, they're no longer around because she had such a horrible, messed up life. And one thing I noticed was that, yeah, they have this need for pain medicine, and they go about getting it, stealing it whatever ways, or buying it off someone who does have it. And it's just really ridiculous. If she would only have been able to go see a doctor, this and that, I think she'd be alive today. Not to mention the cost to other people of deviant behavior when someone gets into a criminal mindset. And a lot of these drugs are probably like stolen from people who need it or who are prescribed it as well. The 15 tablets, as far as being limit for misdemeanor, you know, I'm not familiar exactly, but I think we need to go about treating these drug crimes, a lot of crimes, in a different way. I'd like to get into DUIs have been referenced as far as alcohol. I think the mere fact that it's treated like a criminal offense and the third offense, this progressive menu is ridiculous. I think, you know, DUIs, I got a DUI, I was driving safely, but I had to go rescue this drug-addicted female who, like I described earlier. Anyways, I didn't know about her drug addiction until later on. But, anyway, it's just, yeah, I got DUI because she was, like, an absurd, I mean, you know, she was in need of help. It was cold. No heat in her house. She's, like, you know, calling up for help, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know. Anyway, I try and help her, and of course, I get myself in trouble. I accept that, but I think the progressiveness of of this DUI law is ridiculous. I don't personally want to ever drive again because I've had some physical injuries, head injuries,
Keep some kind of a time limit here, so can you wrap up? I'd appreciate it.
Well, I just thought he gave someone 20 minutes. I really have not prepared much to address today this topic, but I do think that we really need to take the progressivity out of all your laws.
All right.
This misdemeanor stuff, when it should just be like a fine. I mean, if you're going to fine someone, but I think a lot of these laws are just totally ridiculous.
Thank you. So I appreciate your comments are taken to heart on the stacking of the charges, I think is probably the better way of saying it. So thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time out, and I have to move along. Sorry. Thank you very much, Carl. We do have others on for questions, but I think that is the testimony list that I had here. Anything else, Senator Dyson?
Only that I'd like to quickly get that house cleaning amendment in that Mr. Kopp talked about.
All right. Do you have the amendment before us?
Yes, I do.
All right. Taking it easy. You didn't. We have the amendment before us, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I move Amendment 1.
Object so I can hear what you got to say on this.
Yeah, it just changes some incorrect numbers on page 3, line 11.
And what are the substances being referenced here?
So we were intending to reference heroin. We're actually not familiar with the drug that she referenced. Later on in the document, the drafter made it correct. I'm sorry, not heroin, LSD. My fault. It unifies the internal consistency of the document.
So the reference we're deleting, we don't know what that is.
Right. It was a simple error on her part.
Okay. But we do know what the new reference is, 1171.150B12.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And it is
reference to LSD, okay. And it just makes it consistent with page 5 of the bill, which is also reference to LSD of that card.
Any further discussion on the amendment? I'll remove my objection. Amendment passes. Senator Dyson, you want to move the bill along? You want to? Goes to Finance Committee yet?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 56, an act relating to certain crimes involving controlled substances, providing for an effective date. It is the /N version with individual recommendation and attached fiscal note.
Any objection to moving the bill from committee? Hearing no objection, we'll move Senate Bill 56 as amended to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. It's on its way to Finance Committee. The next bill that I wanted to bring before us is Senate Bill 22. Senate Bill 22 has been one that has been before us, what, 8 different times?
And here's the new amendment.
Where are the other ones at?
The other ones are right in your
packet.
What version are we on?
We're on the N version.
Mm-hmm.
Annie, why don't you come on forward?
And that's another variant.
Annie, it looks like we have 3 different amendments on this yet to go. One of them is one I will move, and it's a conforming amendment. It deals with page is N2, and I'll explain it. Last time we met previously, we removed from the bill the section on the witness requirement before the judge instead of instead of a proctor only. And this deals with the page 2. You have the amendment before you?
Yeah, I do. This would remove the accompanying court rule amendments, which are no longer necessary if the immunity sections are not there.
So it's really conforming with a policy call we already discussed, which, quite frankly, the Department of Law was not thrilled with, but it's there. So this is just a conforming amendment. Any objection to the amendment? I will move amendment number N.2. I have to look to my recorder over there. What is this actual amendment number? My apologies. I should have asked you. This will be amendment number 1 to the amended version. So I will call it amendment number 1 today. Is there any objection to amendment number 1? All right. We'll remove that. Senator Dyson has one that will deal with N.4. Senator Dyson, and we'll call this amendment number 2.
So, Mr. Chairman, it has Senator Dyson's name on it. We're going to go ahead and put my name on it.
Okay.
So I move, I guess it'd be an amendment number 2.
2, right. And I'll object.
To explain it. So this is a compromise conversation with Senator Dyson about the volunteer provision being struck from the section in Title 47, 17020. That's the mandatory reporter section of Alaska state law that would have required both paid coaches and volunteers in a more broad category to require child abuse, if they reasonably suspect child abuse, to report it to professionals. Again, not required to investigate, but to report. And I think Senator Dyson brought up some fair points, which is that, number one, let's connect it to a volunteer that really has a lot of contact with children, so 4 hours a week for 4 consecutive weeks, or 20 hours a week in a one-month period, and that was also a Department of Law suggestion, that you focus on the amount of contact with a potentially abused child, or a child that they may reasonably suspect was abused, and then has received training under the requirements of AS 47-17022. And the form part, I think, is good. Assigned a form acknowledging that the coach is required to report child abuse or neglect. And that stems from the senator's concerns that a volunteer may not be aware that there are penalties associated with a failure to report a reasonable suspicion. And again, I just emphasize, no prosecutions under this chapter, no lawsuits, but I'm very sympathetic to the point that we are changing the culture and that we should do so with care to both sides. I do think that if we err, we should err on the side of kids, and I appreciate Senator Dyson working with me on that. I understand his point, which is that you've got volunteers in there and you want them to be aware of what their obligations are. But again, I emphasize it's reasonable suspicion, and they're not required to investigate themselves. We want them reporting to professionals who will investigate, but we are the number one in the nation still in all categories of child abuse. It's just a pervasive problem that we have. And again, the chapter, the last point I want to make is, when I really looked at Title 47, 17020 and mandatory reporters, it really encapsulates the point of it, which is that the earlier that you can report an incident of child abuse that turns out to be child abuse, whether it's physical or sexual, the better off the chances of that child going on to have a good life are, the better off the chances are. And so that's, when you go back and you look at the purpose of it, it's to protect our kids, it's to be on their side, and I appreciate Senator Dyson working with me on it. It's a modification that makes it very narrow, and again, to clarify, it's only in the area of athletic activities. And there are people who would like to broaden it more. There are other people who, other states, in fact, that have mandatory reporting applied to all classes of people. We're not doing that. We're just taking the small step here in the area of athletic volunteers.
Thank you. From the Department of Law, any comment on this?
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the department supported volunteer coaches reporting under all circumstances. So if this is certainly a compromise that we would be happy with, considering the fact that the committee already had decided to eliminate it completely. So yes, I would support this as compared to what what is in the current draft. It is conceptual. I would like to be able to look at it more carefully and work with whoever is working with it on changing what is in the bill now to reflect these changes.
Thank you. Senator Dice, anything? Well, I'll remove my objection, and we'll have it in the bill. Without objection, the amendment passes. That'll bring us to N.3, which I'll call amendment number 3. I'll move amendment number 3. Object for me, one of you two.
Object.
All right. So I can explain.
For purposes of discussion.
Yes. This is the compliance information in the reporting of the judges. So this is the section that we have been working on when the Judicial Council reports on judges in the election pamphlet, that election pamphlet is under the Department of Law's original. They reference an exact statute dealing with how they complied with victims' issues. And so this would take the statutory language out and insert that they are considering the condition of the victims and then also where the offenses involved victims. And this is something that the court was concerned about. And so, Annie, have you had a chance to look at this language?
Yes, I have, and I think Ms. Mead is
all right. So, Ms. Mead, why don't you come and speak to it, and we'll take a look at this language. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and this is a compromise that we worked out with the Department of Law, and the Judicial Council has acknowledged that this would be doable. They and the court can implement it without a problem, and this does mean that the council will be reporting on the judge's obligation to articulate the impact on the victim, whether the victim is present there, and the court should sure. listen and acknowledge and consider the victim's statement, or if the victim is not there and the judge receives information from the prosecutor or elsewhere about the victim, the judge will consider that. And so this language is acceptable.
Okay. Thank you. I think, you know, it's one of those constitutional questions on taking care of the victims. Certainly we want to make sure that the public is notified. So it answers a question that we've lingered on many, many times already in this bill. So is there any objection to this amendment?
I remove my objection.
All right. Amendment number 3 passes. It will also be found in the amended version of Senate Bill 22. So thank you, Ms. Mead. That brings Senate Bill 22 before us amended many times. And it does go to Finance Committee. You know, I'm open to discussion. We can hold the bill over and look at it again, but I think we have debated all points that we need to debate at this point. The Finance Committee gets to look at it. If we move this along, is everybody satisfied that they can explain where we're at?
I am, and I feel like we've spent, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the amount of time you've spent on it, and I think the Department of Law has done a great job of walking us through it, and it's a 90-day session. We're not rushing it, but I think it's time to move it on. I'd be happy to give you a motion if you'd like one.
Before I do that, any comments from the Department of Law at this point?
Mr. Chairman, just to thank you for your attention to this bill. We really appreciate it.
All right.
Good bill. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the committee substitute for CS for Senate Bill number 22 as amended here today, including 3 amendments, 1 conceptual, and the attached fiscal notes out of Judiciary and onto the Senate Finance Committee.
Any objection? Hearing no objection, we'll move Senate Bill 22 to the next committee of referral. Let's take a brief at ease. Let's go ahead and sign some papers. Testimony coming up on Senate Bill 49 in a moment. Now we are going to be hearing public testimony around the state and in the room on Senate Bill 49. and we have several people calling in, so we got 45 minutes. I will keep a timer at 2 minutes. I will ask you to wrap up, and I appreciate it. For the most part, people have kept it right at 2 minutes. I think you can make your point in 2 minutes, but every once in a while, if there's something that needs to be said beyond that, I'll just remind you to wrap it up, all right? First, we have in Fairbanks. Let's go to Fairbanks, my hometown. I got Nancy Bienvenue. Nancy, are you there, and can you hear us?
Yes, I am, and I can hear you.
Thank you. Please just put yourself on the record, your name, any affiliation, and give us your testimony.
All right. For the record, my name is Nancy Bienvenue, and I am a registered nurse, and I currently am the former CEO of the CareNet Pregnancy Center of the Tenenbaum Valley, which is a nonprofit faith-based organization that offers life-affirming assistance for women that are facing an unplanned pregnancy, and that also includes post-abortion assistance for the later effects of abortion. I have been a registered nurse for since 1977, and 20 of those years have been spent in women's health care in a variety of clinical settings. I am a mother, and I'm a grandmother, and I'm a mother of four children. I have a personal testimony as well. Two of my children are in Fairbanks. One is in Texas, and one is in heaven, because I chose to abort him in 1975. And I've heard a lot of testimony last, yesterday and last week, but mostly yesterday, about pro-abortion rights folks talking about not getting into the shoes of that woman and not judging that woman and not wanting to presume to guess about her reasons for seeking an abortion. Well, I have been there. Made some foolish and careless choices in 1975 and went to an abortion clinic in San Antonio for an elective procedure. It was inconvenient for me at the time. I was not ready. I wanted to have a wedding the next summer, and I didn't want to have a baby. Interfere with that. I was very selfish, very self-focused, and it was completely elective. I went into the abortion clinic after I made that appointment, and as I was fine, they asked me about how I was going to pay for it, and they asked me if I was employed. I was a nursing student at the time, and my father had passed for the previous, and I told him that, and they said, okay, sign here, and we'll take care of it. And I said, well, don't you need for me to pay the money? And they said, no, the state's going to pay for it. And I was stunned that the state would pay for it. I didn't understand hardly anything back then that I do now, but I just remember being astounded that the state would pay for my elective abortion based upon my foolish choices and the predicament that I've gotten myself into. So that's the testimony that was being spoken about yesterday was talking about this Senate Bill 49 being about freedom and privacy for women and the right for women to make a choice with her doctor about abortion, but it really isn't. It's about funding. It's about funding that abortion, that elective abortion, and they struggled with the word elective. Absolutely, you can determine if something is elective or not. What's difficult to determine is, on the other side of the spectrum, it is sometimes difficult to determine medical necessity, you know, and that's why there is this bill proposed to define and clarify that. But elective is elective. You make a foolish choice, you make a mistake, and it's inconvenient. You know, there's a huge variety of reasons for having an abortion, but those reasons are very large in the spectrum.
Nancy, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. I hate to do this, but it's over 3 minutes.
Okay, well, I will just say one more thing. The wording that is in these statutes is because of the sensitive nature of this and because of abortion being what it is and that the struggle that we all as a society have about abortion. But the wording is there. If the wording wasn't there, then, you know, if we have an for any reason, I have the wording in the first place. The wording is there that it's for medical necessity. And this is a challenge to our culture to embrace what's good and what is moral and what is sensible. And since the woman's right, those statutes were put there, and I we need to grapple with that. And I urge the legislature to consider that about making a choice for what is good and sensible and moral on this issue instead of what is going to be so protective of rights beyond the scope of what we need to be doing that. So that is my plea is for...
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. That helps. You're a registered nurse. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you. That helps. We're trying to define medical necessity, and I think you made a good point on that. I have Grady Pinnell in Eagle River.
Hello?
Grady, thank you for coming in to testify. Identify yourself, affiliation, and give us your testimony.
Yes, I'm Dr. Grady Pinnell. I'm a pastor of Eagle River Grace Church, Eagle River, and I am for SB 49 because I really think it gives the unborn child more of a fighting chance for life. In my congregation, I have five physicians, two nurses, and two mental health professionals, all of which would favor the passage of SB 49. I'd also like to point out that I think it is consistent with the teachings of the majority of the world religions. And if you want to check, fact check me on that, I was a Navy chaplain for 26 years. You can go to the Pew Forum on Religious and Public Life and check the work they've done on the survey of the faith groups in the world. There are some that don't, but for the large majority of the faith groups in the world, they would support this kind of legislation and their religious teachings. The last thing is, the personal anecdotal evidence is that 40 years, we celebrated Roe v. Wade, 40 years ago, I know the three African-American men who were born that probably would not have ever been born if the kind of abortion laws were on the books that we have today. One of them is Dr. Ben Carson, who you're well, you probably well aware of, born to a young mom, no dad, and 13 years old when his mom, when the mom got born, when he was born, and yet Johns Hopkins, just a world-class surgeon. There's also a good preacher friend of mine, Dr. Willie Bauckham, down in Houston, Texas, who was born to a 16-year-old. African-American single mom. He's a great preacher, man of God. And I will also point out that it's very likely that the President of the United States may have not been born if abortion was as easy to get when he was born. Again, I'd just like to say I'm in favor of it. I want to thank you for considering this legislation, and may God bless Alaska.
Thank you, Grady. Appreciate that very much. Appreciate you calling in. Patricia Steen, is it?
And hello?
Yes, Patricia, go ahead and put yourself on the record, your any affiliation, and give us your testimony.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. As Patricia Steen, I'm from Senate District M. I'm a citizen, a woman, a mother, and a teacher, history teacher for the past 40 years. I've been in Alaska since 1981. I'm calling in to strongly oppose changing the wording of the provision for publicly funded abortions. Legal abortion is the law of this country, and we cannot discriminate between which women can choose and which women cannot. This is really about access and the civil rights of citizens under the 14th Amendment, in my opinion, clear and equal treatment under the law, plain and simple. That being said, I have two specific points I would like to make. According to your own figures, abortions have been declining in Alaska, and the number of publicly funded abortions have been going down. According to the paper, figures from 2010 at 831 for 290,000 to this year, 2012, with 539 abortions covered at 191,000. According to the U.S. study by the Department of Agriculture in 2011, the average cost of raising one child in the U.S. in a two-parent household is from age 0 to 18 is $169,000, and in a one-parent household around $158,000. How can we justify the cost and benefits of bringing children into the world when their parents cannot or unwilling to support them? The total amount paid for all the publicly funded abortions here in Alaska would just pay for one child who needed to be on public assistance throughout his or her life. This just doesn't make sense. There are elementary schools here that are up to a third of their children are in free breakfast and lunch programs. number of neglected and homeless children has grown exponentially in the tough economic times here in Alaska. There are too many assaults that go unreported in Alaska, and that places an unfair burden on women in dangerous situations. I think we can all agree on that. My second point is that the wording would put us in the same category as countries like Iran, Syria, and Haiti. The existing law puts us in the majority of countries like Australia, Canada, Germany, Italy, France, even Spain, a Catholic country, and Mexico. How come we've been so far out of touch with the rest of the democratic world as to go so far backwards? The number of abortions decline proportionately with the access of affordable birth control, adequate sex education, adequate and available health care, and the ability to support the children adequately. These are essentials to prevent the need for many abortions. To sum up, two-thirds of the women in the world have abortion on request written into the laws of the land for a broad range of social, economic, and personal reasons. The wording you are proposing is a direct conflict with this concept, and I believe completely unconstitutional considering the Supreme Court's decision and the 14th Amendment. Abortion rights need to be safeguarded and supported for all women, regardless of their economic status. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking time to come testify, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I too thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I hope I didn't misunderstand, but early in your testimony, you seemed to be making the point that part of the criterion for why we all allow abortion is just economic, that it's too expensive to raise them, and also that perhaps you were suggesting we ought to allow an abortion just because the kid might be poor. Did I misunderstand you?
No, I guess my point here is that a woman who elects to have an abortion, I guess we're talking about elective abortions here, that elects to have an abortion, and really what we're talking about here is the public assistance component, because abortions are legal for people who actually can afford them. And so we're not talking about the abortion itself, but the actual public funding of the abortion. And so I guess it's just basically what this rule, what the proposing of this wording is addressing, as far as I can see.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. We have Joshua Decker with the ACLU. You hung online all last testimony, so thank you very much. Give your testimony, please, Joshua, your affiliation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, very nicely.
Thank you. My name is Joshua Decker. I'm a staff attorney with the ACLU of Alaska. We submitted written testimony to the committee on February 27, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for letting me supplement that today. Briefly, to note what we stated in our written testimony, this bill has some serious constitutional problems, and to touch on at least two of them, one, it violates the separation of powers in Alaska. The Supreme Court's decision in the State versus Planned Parenthood, which established a constitutional right for women on Medicaid to receive medically necessary abortions, is a decision of constitutional dimension. And the legislature simply lacks the power to alter that through legislation. And so, at best, SB 49, even if it perfectly mimicked the contours of the constitutional right the Supreme Court articulated, is a nullity. But here, because it seeks to limit those rights, it's unconstitutional from a separation of powers view. It's also unconstitutional from an equal protection view, both because this bill is animated from a desire to limit abortions, which is not a neutral criterion for the state allocating the spending of its money to Medicaid recipients. It's also unconstitutional from an equal protection view because, unlike the many other instances of the term medically necessary in Alaska law, we list in our letter numerous other occasions where medically necessary is in the Medicaid regulations. SB 49 would stand alone, and its restrictive, narrow definition of what medically necessary is, including heightening the bar of what medically necessary is to something that would cause a life endangering physical condition or place the mother in danger of death or bodily impairment, as well as its omission of psychological harm violates the equal protection clause of the Constitution because it does not treat women who receive Medicaid assistance equally. For those reasons, we ask the committee not to pass this bill. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that the members of the committee may have.
And thank you. And we did get your written testimony, very well written. Totally disagree with it, but I understand your argument, and I'm hoping that along the way here we can bring a good argument to the table that'll show, you know, our position in its strength. So thank you very much, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I thank you, too, for your testimony. Aside from the Supreme Court decision here or comparable ones, is there any time in the history of ACLU in America that the ACLU has ever held or put forth the opinion that an unborn child has value or worth on its own?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Dyson. The positions that organization takes are principled ones that our board of directors comes to. We certainly believe everyone has value. This bill doesn't speak to that, though. This bill speaks to an unconstitutional discrimination of publicly funding a constitutional right.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that, sir. I'm just asking the question. Does the organization consider that an unborn child, wanted or unwanted, has value, intrinsic value and worth on its own?
Through the chair, certainly, but that's not the end of the inquiry, Senator. And as the Supreme Court has conclusively stated, this bill would offend a long-standing constitutional requirement, and if passed, it would ensnare the state in expensive and unnecessary litigation.
I understand that. I heard it the first time. And I understand also clearly that you didn't answer my question, but I appreciate that, and thanks for testifying.
And we'll move along because the debate really is medical necessity in its definition. Sherry Wright in Anchorage, are you there?
I am.
Go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation, if any, and give us testimony.
Thank you. My name is Sherry Wright. I am testifying on my own behalf, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I was one of the young women who was pointed to a solution of abortion to my problem pregnancy when I was 17 years old. Since that time, I had one tubal pregnancy, a risk that was explained to me prior to my procedure, and subsequently I've not been able to have a child of my own, another risk that was explained, but at 17, you really think you're invincible, and I didn't really think that could happen to me, maybe somebody else. Besides being left with children that I cannot hold at this time, abortion affected my life in numerous other ways, but one of the main things is the effect it had on relationships and subsequent choices that I made. I felt unworthy to even live because in my heart I knew I'd done the worst thing a woman could ever do, taking the life of her unborn child. So I didn't really care what I did, and I did many foolish things. At the time, I didn't tie that to the abortion, but I realized it really was the tie that bound me up for nearly 30 years. It took me that long to seek help for that burden that I'd carried, because at the time I vowed I would never speak about this to anyone. I think many women feel the same way. It's a dark part of our past that we'd rather forget, but the blood of the innocent cries out. I think the abortion industry banks on that silence. I got peace about that horrible choice that I made only because of the grace of God that came through much prayer and finally telling my secret. I am a volunteer as a post-abortion counseling and educating coordinator, and I can tell you that most of the women that come to our group share that their main reason for aborting their child was convenience. One thought that has recently occurred to me, prompted by a recent news article, was that even animals have a sense of loss when one of their offspring is taken, whether by a hunter or some act of nature. How is it anyone can think a human being feels nothing when they realize it was their child that was taken? Thank you for your consideration of my testimony. I would be happy to answer any questions, and I hope that this common sense bill will pass through our legislature.
Thank you First of all, appreciate you stepping up to testify. One of the questions that we have to answer as we move along this is if the psychological, emotional cost should be weighed in the balance of should the state pay for it or not. So part of the proposal is, under the equal protection argument, that it could have psychological harm if she has the pregnancy. What I hear is your testimony is it could be psychological damage if she has an abortion.
And I can testify that, and also, sir, if you would look online to post-abortion websites, there's something like, I think, 17 million hits. I went on one time just to see, and there was a tremendous amount of people blogging and talking and sharing some of that load on the Internet. And that alone identifies that there's a problem.
Can you repeat that one more time, the citation?
What I said is if you would go on the Internet and Google post-abortion trauma or post-abortion stress, you will find it. And I don't know if it's 17 million, but I know there was a very large number.
Okay.
And I think it was 17 million the day that I went on. A site that maybe blog sites or people posting about trauma that they've experienced as a result of abortion. There's a huge number of people and a lot number that will not share because they haven't come to a place yet where they can talk about it even.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Also in Anchorage, we have Dr. Regina Chenault.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and identify yourself. Give us your affiliation, if any, and your testimony. Thank you, Doctor.
Yes, my name is Dr. Regina Chenault. I am a general surgeon practicing for 20 years. I live in Anchorage. I'm a hockey mom. I'm a mother of three children, and they're my three special blessings from God. I am calling in support of Senate Bill 49 for numerous reasons. I guess I have 2 minutes, right?
Yes.
I'll make it quick. Firstly, I would say that there are, as a medical professional, very few medical conditions that make abortions absolutely medically necessary. In fact, many women, given the chance, the risk that they may continue their pregnancy and have a baby and it may risk their own life, many women on that very same issue choose to have their baby and risk their own life. Mental problems or conditions do not qualify as making it medically necessary for a pregnant lady to have an abortion. There are many mental health patients who go on to have families and children and raise these families and children and contribute to society in great ways. Secondly, Medicaid Alaskan dollars do not need to be spent killing babies. Babies are valuable gifts from God. They do have intrinsic worth. Next, I would say that abortions cause women I've seen to go on, as just previously testified by the lady, that to become poor choice makers. They become drug addicts, alcoholics. They can commit suicide, kill themselves through other bad choices or bad ways. And it's because of directly related to the mental health problems caused by the abortion that they had. They never get away from that bad decision they made that they didn't understand when they were very young. Many women have babies with congenital abnormalities and syndromes, and they raise these children to go on to have very fulfilled lives and be part of a very good family as best they can make for them. The next point I would make is that many women with cancer or other diseases, again, choose to risk their own life, their own treatment, to make sure that their baby is born. As a surgeon, I would like to share two very quick stories because I know I'm running out of time and these are recent. I was on call for the emergency room. I was called down by the emergency room doctor to come down to the ER to see a 17-year-old young lady for appendicitis. The ER doctor said to me on the phone, and she is pregnant. So I went down to the ER and I spoke with the patient. I examined her, discussed with her the appendectomy, the surgery, anesthesia, the risks inherent to her having the surgery to her baby. And I was really struck by how beautiful she was, how well-spoken she was, how intelligent she was my initial impression of her. And when I talked to her about getting informed consent and especially the risk to the, her baby, her unborn baby, she said, and this is a quotation, "Oh, I don't care about this baby. I'm having an abortion on Thursday, and it's my third one." And she was a Denali Kid Care beneficiary of Alaska Medicaid program. The second story that I'll share is much like that first one. I was called to see another young lady with a problem with her gallbladder who was also pregnant, and as I discussed all of her options with her about her gallstones and gallbladder disease and complications inherent of that problem, she said, quotation, "I don't care about the baby. I'm having an abortion next week." And she was also another Medicaid Denali Kid Care beneficiary. And I just disagree that Medicaid should be paying, as in these two examples that I have provided to the committee, for these types of abortions.
Doctor, thank you for testifying. One of the questions that comes before us as we entertain this bill is not only the physical health. You know, the doctor at this point would have to consider the physical health, but in the discussion is the psychological or mental health of the patient as a taken it into consideration for medical necessity. It seems to me in previous testimony that post-abortion mental health may also be one of the questions, but in your opinion, should we put in some psychological portion of this to prove up a medical need for an abortion?
I can only, you know, I've served on the Violent Crimes Board for over 10 years. I can only see that in the instances we have, because we do have such high domestic violence and sexual assault and abuse of children in our state, that the cases of incest may be the only category that I would see that would maybe should be included in there to cover the mental health of that kid. But there are a lot of sisters who have with their fathers their own brother or sister, and I think that mental health is are those at-risk young ladies.
Well, just as to be fair, we actually put that in the language of the bill, medically necessary was the result of a rape or incest. So
yes.
I think, all right, thank you. I just wanted to double check with you. And I'm going to move along because we have only 15 minutes. I've got a whole group of people. So let me say this. My intention is not to try to move this bill out of committee today. I will come back a week Monday in the evening time to finish out the public testimony. So I'm going to finish up this sheet, and then I'm going to ask anybody about a time constraint, and then we will go out. I've got one, two, three, four. I've got five more on this one sheet. That's the very first sheet that I had of seven sheets. So my apologies. And I will ask in the room and on the line anybody who cannot come back to. So for the next 15 minutes. So Patty Price and Wasilla.
Hello?
Patty, thank you for joining us in this committee. Put yourself on record and give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Patty Price. I'm calling on behalf of myself. And I'm really just calling to say I support this initiative.
Thank you. That was nice and brief. That leaves time for other people who have longer testimony. Thank you, Patty, for joining us. Connie Bell is in Petersburg.
My name is Connie Bell, and I'm from Petersburg, and I'm calling on behalf of myself. I don't have much to add that hasn't already been said in support of the Bill 49. I'm definitely for that. I think, especially having Planned Parenthood testify that they don't understand electives, it makes it pretty clear that we need to define those things, and medically necessary needs to be defined. One thing I would say, I believe that the unborn child does have intrinsic value on its own, given by God, and that our rights aren't derived by law. Originally, they are from God, and that good law holds them. And so I think in order to make that law a good law, it needs to be clarified so we know what is medically necessary and we don't find the state spending money for things that the people don't want it to. So that's my testimony. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Connie, thank you very much for joining us. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks' Jean Brammer.
Yes.
I hope I said that right.
Yes.
Please put yourself on record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Jean Brammer. I'm an OBGYN physician, and I have been for 18 years. I don't have a lot of background on political or research base, and so my testimony really comes from 18 years of dealing with patients, and solely women patients. And I feel very strongly about this, to be in support of Senate Bill 49. I'm very passionate about it. I've also been a medical director for the CareNet Pregnancy Center here in Fairbanks, as well as where I was previously, and so I've had a lot of background with this. But, you know, when I was reading the bill, the things that really stood out to me is this is not so much a pro-life and pro-choice debate. This is about funds. This is about funding. And, you know, Medicaid and every other government organization and every other organization on this planet have a limited funds. And so the definition of medically necessary is very important to be defined, because otherwise, you know, we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars on elective abortions. And even though Planned Parenthood doesn't understand what that is, I do. Elective abortion is an inconvenient pregnancy, a pregnancy that wants to be terminated for no medical reason. And there are very few medical reasons that really would make it reasonable. And even, you know, there, and the list is even very broad, and most physicians would never recommend somebody terminate a pregnancy because of a kidney infection. But it's on there. And so, you know, this is, you know, this list is very broad and is going to cover the women that it should cover. It's going to cover the rape and incest. It's going to cover a lot of things that, you know, really should, you know, allow that woman to have access. But it's not going to allow Alaskan tax dollars to pay for elective abortions. You know, private insurance does not cover elective abortion, so I don't understand why Medicaid should be covering it. You know, I am very passionate, very pro-life, and I still don't believe that Medicaid should cover infertility treatment. There are limited funds here, and, you know, we need to allocate those the best we can. So, you know, this is a very good bill to kind of start to give us some clarity on what's important. You know, they were talking about the infections. I personally had appendicitis when I was 17 weeks pregnant with my first child. Never in a million years would I have considered an abortion. But, you know, I was fully, you know, informed and took on that responsibility and went on to have a healthy child, as most women would. But, you know, we're going to allow some of these things to be included in the bill so that women can make that choice. But we're not going to give them the choice of a free abortion. You know, people were talking about the back alley abortions. This has nothing to do with this. This, you know, we're not trying to change the legalization of abortion. We're not changing access to medical care for low-income women, middle-income women, high-income women. All that access is still there. The legality of elective abortions is still there. You know, back alley abortions weren't free either. Those people still had to come up with funding to pay for that. And so if people choose to have an elective abortion, whether they have private insurance or Medicaid, you know, they're not going to be covered. That's going to be something that's their own expense. Just like, you know, if you would like to drive a really nice car, you need to have that expense. I mean, this is, you know, this is not a pro-life, pro-choice debate. It's simply about funding. And so I'm very passionate and very much in support of Senate Bill 49.
Jean, thank you very much for coming to our committee and testifying. I greatly appreciate it. We're going to go over to Palmer real quick. Dr. William, is it Reisinger?
Dr. William Reisinger.
Reisinger.
Senator.
Thank you very much for coming to committee and testifying.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I'm a physician. I have lived in Palmer since 1984, and I'm a radiologist. I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in 1969. At that time, we took the original Hippocratic Oath, which prohibits or forbids abortion as well as euthanasia. Sadly, that has changed in recent years. I'm a radiologist. I was finished my training in the late 70s, early 80s. I moved to Palmer in 1984. I've been a practicing physician for 44 years. I'm calling because I'm a radiologist, and I guess I'm in a unique position to testify on behalf of the unborn. I've seen ultrasounds go from a very crude mechanism of echolocation of the midline of the brain, that's all we could see, to very fuzzy images, to more exquisite images. For finally, we now have exquisite detail and live images, and even in three dimensions. I have had many years of observing live images of unborn children. And I guess the reason, one reason I'm passionate is recently I saw, especially on PBS, of the abolitionists. And one of the things that the abolitionists did to indicate that slavery was wrong, they had a little pin that they wore, and it showed a picture of a man who was a slave, and it said, "I am a man." I guess I'm here to testify that over the years I have seen unborn children react just as much as living, as born children would. And so I'm here to testify that they're human beings too. I've seen amniocentesis where the doctor places a needle into the amniotic cavity. And during the procedure, I watch to make sure that there's no harm is done. And sometimes the unborn child reaches out, touches the needle, and recoils from it, just as any human being would do. I've seen unborn children grab hold of the umbilical cord and play with it. I guess the reason I'm calling then is that the only surgical procedure we have in medicine with 100% mortality is abortion. Two living human beings go into that procedure by design, only one leaves. The reason that I think it's important that we have medical necessity clearly defined is that if we're going to eliminate a human being, then we must consider that very carefully. Under what circumstances, under what medical necessity should we pay for abortions for a human being to be destroyed? I guess that is my main points.
Doctor, I sure appreciate you taking the time to come and testify. I'm going to go to an off-net to take note of somebody who is waiting online. Doctor, is it Iona Farr?
Hi, this is Dr. Ilona Farr.
Thank you. I almost got the name right.
Yes.
Just identify yourself online and give us your testimony, please.
Okay. I'm a family physician who's been a resident of Alaska for 52 years. I practiced medicine back home for 26 years, and I am definitely speaking out in favor of SB 49. You know, as a physician, I do my best to promote life, and I don't wish to be paying for abortions that are not medically necessary if this results in the death of unborn Alaskan children with my tax dollars, and that is an idea that's totally abhorrent to me as a Christian. 18 states now have passed legislation prohibiting abortions in the new health exchanges or marketplaces, and these are the ones that are being set up under Obamacare ACA, and these violate the Hyde Amendment. So it's vitally important that Alaska sets a clear standard for what is medically necessary now before the federal government imposes their own definition. I've actually had a chance to look at the list of things. I would actually remove kidney infection from the list or put kidney infection only with sepsis because kidney infections are fairly common during pregnancy and it's not a reason for an abortion. I would also add congenital fetal abnormalities incompatible with life, as there are times when the brain does not form properly or a child does not have kidneys, and then a mother is forced to make a difficult decision. And oftentimes, when children have these congenital abnormalities, it results in problems or complications with the pregnancy. So I do think that should be added to this list. Mental health issues by themselves are not a reason for abortions or are economical reasons. I have several patients with severe mental and physical disabilities, including one with schizophrenia who is now raising 5 children by herself and doing a good job of it. I've seen many women who have become depressed and turned to alcohol and drug use following abortions to numb the pain of killing their unborn children. And in my practice, I actually had a woman that committed suicide after having an abortion. I have also had one that died because of a congenital heart disease when they became pregnant. And then I've also seen women, again, with these congenital abnormalities have to make very difficult decisions when the baby was non-viable about whether or not to continue the pregnancy or terminate it. These are rare exceptions, though. They're less than 4% of abortions actually are of medical necessity. But most abortions in the state are elective. They are choice on the part of the mother, and these should not be paid for with our tax dollars. I also know of a person who developed breast cancer while pregnant and successfully underwent treatment while pregnant, and both she and the baby are well. So as medicine advances, we'll see less need of abortions, and thus we need to get very clearly worded legislation passed to limit taxpayer-funded abortion, as there are many places in the world where abortions are forced upon women, and we do not want that here in Alaska.
Doctor, could you make sure that we get that by way of email to this to the chairman? I'll make sure they get that in the committee. Kidney with sepsis and congenital fetus abnormalities is what I got. Is that correct?
Congenital fetal abnormalities incompatible with life.
Okay.
Because, you know, sometimes they can have congenital abnormalities like Down syndrome. That's compatible with life. I've got several Down children that I take care of or know of, and they do very well. So these are congenital abnormalities that are incompatible with life.
All right.
And so there is a difference there. And so I do have my testimony in email. Also, the first day of testimony, there was an answer to the question. I do ultrasounds personally before I do any biopsies of the uterus or any type of uterine procedure. And I know most physicians do pelvic ultrasounds before any type of uterine procedure should be performed.
So,
and I know that was something that was brought up early.
As one of the testimonies made it sound like it was a repugnant thing that a ultrasound would be either vaginally or internally inserted. Has there been a complaint of that down through the years?
No. I mean, most women want, you know, before I do any type of biopsy of the uterus, I want to know what's there. You know, are you dealing with a cancer? You know, are you dealing with an ectopic pregnancy? You know, in case of an abortion, you definitely want to know the age or if there's complications, other things that are there. So I think an ultrasound is very important, whether it be abdominal or transvaginal ultrasound. I think it should be done before any type of intrauterine procedure is performed.
Thank you, Doctor. I surely appreciate that. Helped me with some questions and maybe even helping us with a bill. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, I find myself in an awkward position of time running out. But I have asked the people in the room previously if they had time schedule problems. And so people have said in this room now the second hearing. And so I'm going to offer them the opportunity to come forward at this point. And my apologies. My intention is in a week, Monday, I will have an evening meeting. I will publish it, and I will make sure that everybody gets a chance to have their say. We'll just run the evening into the evening, and we'll make sure that everybody who has a say gets a say. So is there anybody in the room at this point that cannot come back Monday night and would like to testify at this point? Okay. Sid, I know Sid, so why don't you come on up, and I'll give you the last 2 minutes of the meeting. Okay. All right. I'm sorry, you don't get the last 2 minutes because somebody just raised his hand. He said put yourself on the record. We'll run our meeting about 3 minutes over, and then everybody's going to bail out on me. So,
my name is Sid Heiderstorf. I'm here testifying on behalf of Alaskans for Life. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. We support any effort to remove the state from the abortion business, and we oppose the present practice of paying for all abortions under the state Medicaid program. It is our position that the state should not be funding elective procedures, especially something like abortion, which treats pregnancy like a disease. The Medicaid program is supposed to be used for helping people with physical and mental problems, not aborting healthy babies of healthy women. In our view, Senate Bill 49 does not go far enough, and we are opposed to the notion that there's anything that qualifies as a medically necessary abortion. We support any payment for all abortions. However, we do acknowledge that the legislature is restricted by the courts, and therefore we support Senate Bill 49 as a step in the right direction, and we thank the sponsors for that. However, it does not appear as if the the list of conditions which will qualify for a medically necessary abortion is so broad as to undermine the notion of elective abortions. If the abortionist wishes to circumvent the intention of this statute, it would be easy to do so. We encourage the committee to consider requiring certification by a second physician as to the medically necessary conditions. Also, we note the removal of the requirement from the original version of Senate Bill 49 that for one to qualify for a Medicaid abortion in the case of rape or incest, it has to be promptly reported to the law enforcement or public health authorities. It seems perfectly reasonable that rape or incest be reported to authorities. This is protection for the victim and should be encouraged and required in this case. You will hear numerous compassionate sounding reasons why the state must pay for welfare abortions. However, we reject the argument that compassion for the plight of the poor woman is reason to justify the death of her unborn child. No matter how many reasons are given, no matter how good they sound, when one looks beyond the expression of concern, we are still faced with the realization that abortion takes the life of a child before birth. We support a state program of positive assistance to have mothers, and from the state's viewpoint, it certainly does not provide the compassion and concern that state policy should reflect if they pay for all elective abortions.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up, Sid.
The law is a teacher, and we can be sure that something that's paid for will be increased. And as legislators, you seldom have the opportunity to address an issue which is directly related, literally, to life and death. Senate Bill 49 does just that. We honor those who save a life. Support of this measure has the potential of saving many lives. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we got one last person to testify, and for those online, again, please accept my apology. I know many of you waited online. I tried to get across the state as much as I could, but and then I purposely dissed Juno last week, last time. So please come on up and give your testimony, and you get to be the last one in line, and then we will continue this discussion Monday next week.
Someone once said being last is okay.
Yes.
I'm Dr. George Brown. I've practiced pediatrics in Alaska for many, many years. I've spent much time with many of the families and mothers and young mothers referenced in earlier testimony. First of all, I want to say how much I appreciate sitting here and experiencing the actual practice of responsible free speech. And the courtesy and the respect that I sense is here, because that is so important. You have what I had written. I left it yesterday. But I'm going to really be brief. The main point I want to get across is you cannot separate physical and mental illness. Modern research keeps telling us this, and all we know about post-traumatic stress disorder certainly keeps reinforcing that. And my experience is, and this is also true of my wife, who is an OBGYN and has been for many years, what we should be trying to do is to help those families who and those children who grew up in situations of all the lists that Alaska is so bad at, as much as we can, so that when they get to be 16 or 17, they don't end up thinking they've got to have an abortion. They have some other choices. And believe me, that is hard work. And believe me, many of us continue to do it day in and day out through the Children's Trust Fund, through much more emphasis in private pediatric practice on helping parents with behavior problems. so it can be done. But to say that someone who comes in and is terribly distraught and upset, by definition means there's an emotional need there, and what should happen is wherever it is that they go, every effort should be made to help them make what is the most sensible decision for them, and that is really hard work. Now, you know, it's obvious as I listen to this, what we see depends on from where you are looking. And I want to go back to what I understand about what led up to the Civil War. Many good philosophers and historians have pointed out if the abolitionists had not been quite so certain that they were right, it maybe could have been avoided. And I can't say yes or no. But I do know this, the person who thinks that he's absolutely correct, in my experience, is the most dangerous one. And that's why I said what I did, how comforting it is to hear you listen respectfully, because this is very complicated. I hope that we can do all we can on either side to prevent as many unwanted pregnancies as possible, and there's a lot of room to do that. And in closing, I want to say what I had in the end of my written testimony. Our Alaska and United States constitutions expressly promise freedom of speech, of the press, of public assembly, to petition, and freedom of and from religion. These are solemn and challenging promises. They are not all yet kept for many of us, sadly, for too many of us. If I had somehow been able to add another constitutional promise, I would have added, quote, freedom to practice tolerance everywhere and as often as anyone possibly could. It is important for you to understand that the health of body and mind cannot be separated. I ask you to carefully consider the negative impact I think Senate Bill 49 will have on many of these human beings who come into this situation, and that we do all we can to get better at prevention, because I know that we can do that, and thank you very much.
Thank you, and I appreciate you taking the time, both times, to come here and sit through, listen to the committee. My apologies to all online. My commitment is to make sure that if you have something you want to put on the record, we get it on the record. And it is true that many of us here have worked tirelessly for those who have great needs in Alaska, both young and old, and many of us feel very committed to those who are unborn who have no voice. And so with that, we will call this committee to adjournment.